This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the show, everybody. They say the first guy to ever run a marathon immediately died from exhaustion following the effort. So, of course, now we all do it for fun. Wouldn't that dude be surprised to know that? Today, we are talking about training for distance road races as a triathlete. And I am joined by the top two runners on the TriDot staff. First up is Coach Jeff Rains. Jeff has a Master's of Science in Exercise Physiology and was a successful D1 collegiate runner. He's qualified for the Boston Marathon multiple times and has raced over 120 triathlons from competitive sprints to full-distance Ironmans. Jeff has been coaching runners and triathletes since 2009. Jeff, ready to have a little marathon podcast session here?
I cannot wait to hit the ground running here today, Andrew.
The reoccurring running pun right there.
Never gets old.
Yeah, never. An oldie.
I never run out of those.
There's a new one. There's a fresh one. Up next is pro triathlete and coach Elizabeth James. Elizabeth came to the sport from a soccer background and quickly rose through the triathlon ranks using TriDot, from a beginner to top age grouper to a professional triathlete. She is a Kona and Boston Marathon qualifier who has coached triathletes with TriDot since 2014. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us to talk long distance running.
Well, I am glad to be here. I may not have all the witty puns that Jeff Rains does.
I thank
but
you for that personally.
I am equally excited.
Well, I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and the captain of the middle of the pack. Today we'll get warmed up and then we'll talk through crushing your next marathon or other long distance road race. Then we'll cool down with a TriDot athlete sharing their own fascinating and fun marathon story. It's going to be a great show. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
From the fastest marathon dressed as a vegetable to the longest scarf knitted while running a marathon, a quick trip to the Guinness Book of World Records website reveals so many weird but fun marathon records. So Jeff, Elizabeth, if you were setting out to accomplish a new, obscure 26.2-mile race record, what record would you be aiming to set?
Well, I don't know if it's super weird, but the thought that first came to mind, and this may already be out there, but kind of going back to my love for my first love for athletics, I would combine my previous participation in soccer with my love for running, and I would be going for the fastest marathon while dribbling a soccer ball.
Ah, okay. Very good. Very good. Because obviously you put the ball on your feet and you got something else to do that whole time. You got to keep it controlled. You got to keep it away from other runners' feet.
Mm-hmm.
If you kick it a little bit too far and it bounces off somebody else's foot, you're going to have to go out of your path to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think it'd be a good challenge.
That would complicate things for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Jeff Rains, what would you be looking to set as a new marathoning record?
Well, a few years back, I actually thought about attempting a Guinness World Record. It was one where you push a kid in a stroller. I have a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old, and one on the way. And I thought about attempting that a few years ago. It was like 240 something. I think it was recently broke. I think it's like 231 now.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I can't do that.
Jeff, let me ask you this. How much would I have to pay you to attempt in public to run the fastest naked marathon?
Oh, my gosh. I'm blushing.
Yeah, everybody can't see his face.
Is there
right
a number that would get you to the starting line naked
reaction.
For a marathon?
Would it be at night?
Okay, well, I'll tell you for me, when I was thinking about this, I think it'd be a lot of fun to try to set the fastest marathon record while recording a podcast, right? Like, how on-brand would that be for me at this point? And here's the thing. The thing is, we could pull this off because you guys are faster than me. And, Jeff, you're faster than the both of us, so you could carry the microphones for us
and
the recording equipment. We get like two little handheld recorders. So you just kind of run next to us holding out two recorders, and Elizabeth and I could chit chat, and we could have the fastest podcast episode ever recorded at the marathon distance.
Live.
How about that?
During.
There we go.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Our main set today is brought to you by TriTats. Whether you're a seasoned Ironman or gearing up for your first local sprint try, TriTats will help you make your mark. These tough, stylish, and easy-to-use race number tattoos make you look and feel like a pro. I personally have raced countless local sprint and Olympic tries where I showed up thinking I had plenty of time to settle in the transition, only to find a massive line waiting to be body marked. Switching to TriTats has allowed me to show up on race morning with my focus on the finish line, not the body marking line. If you have an Ironman race this year, their Iron Tats are made especially for you. Iron Tats body mark you for that one key race and include the all-famous M.Dot logo. Friends don't let friends race with Sharpie on numbers. So as a friend of the podcast, head to TriTats.com and use promo code TRIDOT for 10% off your order. Again, that's TriTats.com, promo code TRIDOT. For triathletes especially who are used to getting on the run course already fatigued, the standalone road race is an intriguing chance to really see what we can do in our race day shoes. And today, Jeff and Elizabeth will be talking us through long-distance road racing to help us just kind of peak just in time for race day. So I know you both love the marathon distance, maybe more than anything, and you both have just stupid impressive marathon PRs that I know you're too humble to brag about. So maybe at some point in the episode today, I can pry your PRs out of you. But let's start here today. Take me back to your first marathon. Where was it, and how did it go? Elizabeth, let's start with you.
My first marathon was my husband and my first marathon. We ran the Lincoln Marathon in Lincoln, Nebraska. And as we're walking to the starting line, Charles is just puking in the flower beds of the sorority houses. And he says, you know, it's just from nerves. You know, we're going for our first marathon distance and it's going to be all right. But when he's on the side of the road puking his guts out at mile 10.
Oh, no.
He then discloses that he has a 100-degree fever and decided to start the race anyway.
Charles.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. And to make matters worse, he is wearing like these tiny yellow shorts and little green tank top.
In true runner fashion.
Oh, yeah. Because he and his buddy, who also came for the marathon, decided that they were going to make it kind of this costume party as well. And they dressed up as Prefontaine, mustache and all.
Okay.
Well, Charles and I are both incredibly stubborn. And we had promised each other that we were going to do this first marathon together. So try as I could to convince him to drop out or complete the half instead of the full, he wouldn't do it. He was like, no, we're doing the marathon. And, you know, try as he might to convince me to just go and run it without him, I wouldn't do it either. Because I'm like, no, we said we'd do it together. So we jogged and walked and waited for him to puke for the next 16 miles.
Oh, no.
It's kind of a long day. We finished. And he is, I mean, just ghost white, has crazy fever sweats, puke on his shirt. I'm not even tired. I don't know if I was even sweaty. It was a very lackluster experience for me.
If that was my first marathon, I'm not sure I would go back to do it again.
Right. Yeah. quite the experience there. So, I mean, that was the first one. We kind of joke now that, like, my first marathon was kind of the next spring in Lincoln again. That one went much better, as you can imagine. It was a huge personal best for me. I actually got to run, and that was a little more what I expected it to be. But yeah, that first one was kind of a doozy.
Well, I'm just glad Charles survived it, and I commend your patience on the day. And where, you know, Charles, to his credit, has supported you on very many marathons since then. So
exactly.
Jeff Rains, what was your first marathon?
Mine was the Dallas Marathon, but an interesting kind of side story going into it. The year before, a buddy of mine out of college, he was going for the Olympic Trials B standard at the Dallas Marathon, and at the finish line, he was going to propose to his girlfriend, who was also on our track team. what intrigued me was that you could do a 5-person marathon relay. So some of the other track guys were going to do this relay and pace our buddy. And then we logistically were able to all get on buses after our leg of the marathon to rush to the finish to be there so we could all see him give the proposal. So anyways, doing that relay, I think my section was 5, 6, 7 miles, whatever it was, and just seeing everybody out there and what they go through and how he trained and just all of that motivated me. So I went out the next year and
did it by yourself.
I actually did pretty well and ended up qualifying for Boston in that first one. But the Dallas Marathon holds a special place in my heart for all those reasons and more.
Well, very good. So here's, when we talk about marathon training, we just have to really jump straight to this. Because a lot of athletes ask that come from a triathlon background and they're interested in just doing a standalone marathon or a standalone half marathon even. And the question is this, can you effectively train for a standalone run event with TriDot? Or is it honestly just better to jump into a running only program to prepare for a race like that?
You know, I have multiple athletes that I coach that are just runners, and I shouldn't say just runners, but they use the TriDot platform for their running, and a few of them will incorporate swimming and biking as their cross training, and then a few of them are just straight runners that will never touch a bike or swim. And so the answer to the question, yes, you can effectively train for standalone running in TriDot. You change your preferences to run only, and then you can also inside of that manipulate the volumes, low, standard, or high volume of those disciplines. So and then you can also add a strength component to that as well. So absolutely, the TriDot platform accommodates runners and triathletes.
Yeah, and maybe just to point out, like, I did not qualify for the Boston Marathon on my first marathon attempt, unlike Jeff Rains, who did. I didn't qualify for Boston until I began training with TriDot.
Oh, wow.
And all of my best marathon performances have been while using TriDot as well. I, you know, was following a running-only program, was doing that for a number of years, had done quite a number of marathons, and just never saw the improvement that I did until I started training with TriDot. And so can you do that to train for marathons? Yes. And I've had incredible success and my Boston qualifying performance is doing that too. And I know that there's a number of athletes that have similar experiences qualifying for Boston, running, you know, the 3-hour marathon, following their optimized TriDot training. Athletes are able to put a running event, whether that be a half or a full marathon, into their season planner. And just like TriDot will optimize an athlete's training for a triathlon, it's going to optimize their training for that running event as well.
Great. Yeah.
So yeah, there's no need to switch to, you know, a different run program. You're not missing anything. You're not missing key running sessions. TriDot includes those, you know, quote unquote key run sessions with your weekly long run, those speed work sessions, the aerobic work. And then kind of as Rains was saying too, you're complementing that running with a well-rounded program that already incorporates cross training and strength training.
Yeah. So since it's optimized, it's not like you're not lacking running. You don't
Correct.
Need more running. Mm-hmm. You're getting the running you need to be ready for that race and not just ready to complete it, but ready to do your best at it. So
yeah,
to have
your best performance.
I mean, while you're thinking about that, I'm just thinking back to all of that. I mean, we have a staggering number of Boston qualifiers in the TriDot family who every year annually qualify for Boston and go and race it. And there's several that I remember posting, just people posting their pictures from racing Boston in the TriDot family. So definitely a lot of fasties out there training for their marathons and their half marathons on TriDot. And two of those fasties are the two of you. And I would be remiss to not give you the opportunity to tell us how fast you are, because I know that people want to know. I would want to know. And I'll even brag on you in this way. Both of you PR'd your marathon just this past calendar year. So we're not even talking about, you know, at some point in your younger days, you were super fast. I mean, you guys right now are running your fastest marathons you've ever run in this season of your life. Elizabeth, what is your marathon PR that you just set this past year?
My PR is 3 hours and 59 seconds.
Oh, wow.
So I am desperately working on those 59 seconds to put a 2 in the hour column. But something I'm still very proud of, and that sub 3 hour attempt, I hope to get there soon.
Yes, well, I'll be rooting for you and can't wait to see it. And it's going to happen sooner than later. I believe that. So, Jeff Rains, what is your absurd marathon PR that you've set here fairly recently?
Let's just say I'm knocking on the door of dipping under 250. Very, very close. And kind of to point out what Elizabeth was saying earlier, my first one, I did go out and do decent. Have had a lot of horrible ones since then, but I will say, after spending a number of years in Tri-Dot, you know, that was 10 years ago. And so, having spent a number of years, 5-6 years on Tri-Dot now, I'm in my mid-30s now. I'm not 24 or 25 years old anymore. And so, because of Tri-Dot, I am now much, much faster than I was straight out of college. So because of Tri-Dot, I'm hoping to dip under 250 soon.
And Jeff, your half marathon PR is what, 115, 114?
115, yes, sir.
I have never run a marathon. My first marathon will be in my first Ironman, so that's going to be great. You know, you talked about how the cross-training of swimming and biking while training for a marathon can be good. And I've even seen this. I've seen athletes, on our Tri-Dot Facebook group, they will put a marathon on their race calendar, and they report that it even adds a swim session to their week. And they ask why. And you guys always, as coaches, will give them an answer. But kind of tell me what that answer is. Why is it that swim and biking can serve as such great cross-training for prepping you for a marathon?
So cross training is an incredibly important part of a run training plan. Swimming and biking are excellent cross training that can complement your run training. For example, the zone 2 bike sessions can increase your aerobic capacity. The interval work on the bike is going to help build that leg strength. The swim sessions are also going to help with aerobic capacity. And in fact, they can be great recovery. One of my favorite weekly sessions is an aerobic swim after my long run. After, you know, putting in those longer miles, it just feels great to hop in the pool, take a nice aerobic pace, a little cooler water,
yeah,
elevate the legs a little bit. Great recovery session there too.
Well, in your body, in that scenario, I mean, you're still getting the stamina benefits of, you know, working out. You're just not spending the time on your feet. You're not spending the time pounding pavement in running shoes. You know, that if you're only doing running and training for a long road race, you're just pounding the pavement. I always think to my poor knees and my feet get injured quickly. And you know, if you can build up some of that endurance on the bike or in the pool, that's just less time you're having to pound the pavement on your joints and your legs in anticipation of one of those longer races.
My best times in 5K and above, since college, you know, 10 plus years, have been now because I'm cutting my run volume in half, but I'm adding the cross training aspect of swimming and biking and the other disciplines has made me now faster. Mm. Now, overall, I'm putting more minutes of training per week in, but I've cut the actual running on foot in half, and it's made my running faster than it's ever been, 5K and above. Something, you know, a lot of that has contributed to what we call doing the right training right. Tri-Dot knows the conditions at which I do my training every single day, and my paces and zones are changed throughout the day as the weather changes in my unique city, keeping me safe. And you know,
which, Jeff, we now have a whole podcast episode for that. If folks can go back and listen to podcast episode 48, it talks all about environment normalization and how Tri-Dot does that for you. So I hadn't really considered how valuable that can be just to your day-to-day marathon training, though.
Oh, it's crazy. Supplementing other disciplines and normalizing the day-to-day paces inside of each day is a game changer.
Another big factor in marathon training that it's not a myth, because the long run is just a staple to long distance training, right? You've got to build your stamina up, you know, but some people, you know, they really want to make sure they run the full 26.2, 13.1. They want to get that mileage in before race day. Some people, you know, believe in keeping it under that. How long do our long runs need to be in preparation for a long distance road race?
Knowing what your current threshold is, right, by doing an assessment, and then kind of converting that threshold out to the distances, 13.1, 26.2, and then applying the e-norm, the TriDot's e-norm, environmental normalization, and then training at percentages of that is what you want to do. So kind of examples, if I'm 4 months out from a marathon, right, and I ran a 20-minute 5K, and it's like earlier, it says I'm supposed to run maybe a 3:20. Well, what TriDot will do is take into account the heat and humidity projected for that day and the elevation gain. And so it'll say, no, you're fit enough right now to run 3:20, but you're probably not going to break a 3:45 because of all those elements. Then TriDot for your longer sessions will train you at percentages of the time that you're going to spend on your specific race day, on your specific course.
So it's not so much worried about training to complete that distance. It's training to be able to run at that pace for that the amount of time you're going to be on course on race day.
Exactly, and that's stamina. And so the secret to running fast on race day is to be able to hold certain percentages of your thresholds for longer durations, right? And so what we need to do is get our threshold as high and as fast as we can, so then we can build that stamina around that, right? That's podcast episode number 10. But a lot of people have that maybe little birdie in the back of their mind that they just have to know that they ran, you know, 20 miles or 22 miles before
just to abate that inward anxiety of running that far.
Yeah, there's no magic number in what you need to run, right? I mean, you know, the world will tell you that, you know, you might want to hit at least 65 to 80% of 26.2 miles for your longest long run. You know, arguably your longest long run needs to be 2 to 3 weeks out to give you time to recover a little bit there. But really, for most people, it tends to be around 15 to 21-ish or so miles in there. But really, it's all about a certain percentage of the time you're going to spend on race day, and you build up to that. Certain people can handle or have different capacities to handle that stamina before race day. So it's different for everyone, and that is the key.
You know, but not every session, guys, can be a long run. You know, what are the other run workouts, Elizabeth, that athletes should expect to see in their road race training cycle?
Yeah, I had briefly mentioned earlier that TriDot optimizes an athlete's training and includes kind of those key sessions that you would see in what would be a run-only training plan, such as, you know, your long run, the interval work, the easy runs. So to expand on that just a little bit more, based on an athlete's training stress profile and how much intensity they can handle within a particular session and within a cycle of training, intervals will be prescribed for the athletes to maximize their upcoming race results. And I mean, Rain's alluded to this a little bit earlier, and we dive into even more specifics of the various interval sessions and the importance of following those prescribed paces for the purpose of continuing to develop your functional threshold, because that's what you're holding a percentage of as you increase the stamina and build up for that for race day. So you'll see those interval sessions that are going to help develop your threshold. And then you're going to have, as you mentioned, the long run session, and that's for the purpose of increasing your stamina for the duration of the event that you'll be running, whether that's, you know, the 13.1, 26.2, or beyond. And then those sessions are complemented by the zone 2 or the aerobic run sessions. And those kind of easier runs enhance your aerobic capacity. They can serve as some active recovery. They further your run durability. So those are kind of the, you know, three main types of run sessions that you would see.
Every run serves a purpose.
Yes.
Every run has a place in
and
its
it
rotation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So guys, there are flatter marathon courses. There's hilly marathon courses. There are mostly downhill courses that athletes seek out to not have to run uphill. And there's even courses that take you off the beaten path and are kind of off-road half marathons, marathons, ultra runs. But so tell me, how does the course affect how we train for a run event?
Good question. This has to be brought up on this podcast. So everyone kind of thinks, not everyone, but let's say a newbie or someone wanting to attempt their first marathon, or maybe even, actually, let's do the opposite end of the spectrum. Maybe there's someone who's just been on the cusp of trying to qualify for Boston for a number of years, number of seasons.
Or even just hit a certain time.
Or just hit a certain time and they can't do it. Exactly. So a lot of people will choose a flat or even net downhill marathon, and you even see like, okay, this is the fastest course allowed in our state, right? That is a net downhill, but that is still Boston legal, right? So people do all this research for these flat or downhill marathons.
Or PR-friendly courses.
Exactly. And I would argue that those courses, for most even, are harder. And you think, wait, what? So a course with hills in it can be faster than a net downhill? Absolutely.
Wow.
And that's what people don't quite understand is that on that just super long flat course on concrete, on pavement, all that pounding on a flat course, you use the same muscle groups the entire time, and there's a level of vibration and fatigue. Even on net downhill courses, the stride is elongated on downhills, and a lot of people will have sort of a braking effort or a braking aspect to their stride, and that just wreaks havoc on your quads. Kind of putting on the brakes each step, and so a lot of people can kind of get cramping. And kind of break down kind of those miles 14 to 19. So a little bit of undulation, I would argue, is a faster course, not just huge long climbs, but a little bit of undulations change the muscle groups, change the posture, gives you little breaks here and there, ways to change up your stride a little bit and kind of combat those crampings of that steady state and that just pounding all day long.
So to expand on that a little bit, our form and our posture does break down on some of these different terrains. But in terms of training for the event, we do need to take those things into consideration. But it's not like if you're training for a hilly event, you only go and train on hills. Your body is going to know the effort, but it's not going to necessarily know that, okay, I'm, training on a hill right now. Yeah. Or I'm not. And so there's things in terms of technique and form that need to be taken into consideration. But my training for a hilly course and a flat course doesn't have a lot of difference between them.
Maybe a few isolated sessions, you'll try to find a route that matches that course. But for the most part, you just do the session.
And you're working on the form, you're working on the technique. But in terms of, interval sets that develop my threshold, I'm going to have those no matter what course I'm racing. I'm still going to have the long run. What terrain I'm doing that long run on might vary a little bit. But it's not like if you're training for a hilly course and you live in a flat area, you can't be successful with that either. That's, an absolute possibility.
So even with mixing in swim and bike sessions to cross train and doing the right training without totally just excessive junk miles, even still, we inherently will spend a lot more time in our running shoes training for a long run event. Jeff, are there any kind of shoe rotation considerations we should be making as the miles start adding up?
I would encourage you to do the majority of your training in that kind of heavier, more traditional shoe. Now, in that kind of traditional shoe category, typically is a 300 to 400 mile life expectancy.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a debate out there, or even marketing tools. Our shoe lasts 600 miles before you have to replace it, stuff like that. I've pretty much worn them all out there, and 400 miles is tends to be the max for most. Now, a lot depends on the terrain that you're running on daily and your weight and how much you beat up the shoe. But typically, about 300 miles in to the life of your more traditional shoe, you need to start mixing in a newer model. Start breaking that in as you're finishing out the last little bit of life in your previous shoe. But I've also alluded in other podcasts, ideally, in a perfect world, maybe you would have three different types of shoes, kind of your race day, kind of quote flat, your more minimal, lighter weight, more sleeker race day shoe. You might have the one I was just talking about, your kind of heavier, trainier. Yeah, more traditional.
A little more of a drop.
Absolutely. A little bit more carbon rubber, stiffer, heavier, longer lasting rubber on it. Stuff like that. And then you have your kind of middleweight shoe. For maybe a little bit of both, tempo runs, fartleks, and then maybe for assessments or super hard track workouts, you wear that kind of lighter race day shoe. But I would still argue that 70 to 90% of your running needs to be in that more traditional drop shoe. That drop being 8 to 12 millimeter offset. anything arguably flatter than an 8mm offset, and the ramp inside the shoe tends to kind of be understood as going in that more minimal direction. So just kind of know what you need. About 6 to 8 weeks out from that big key A race, that long distance run race, is when I kind of almost for the first time start to mix in that more race day shoe.
Okay.
So don't be in too big of a rush to do a lot of training in that super sleek, lighter
just
weight
enough
shoe
to be
if you're not used
with
to
it.
Absolutely.
So we put in the training and race day comes. Is there anything athletes need to know about navigating the pre-race environment? Or is packet pickup and showing up kind of similar to a local triathlon?
I would say the day before, do it quickly, do it early, get out there. If it's an outdoor packet pickup, don't stand in the sun all day. If it's a giant expo, just get in, get your stuff. You can shop after the race. Spending a lot of time in expo, waiting in lines, kind of just trashes those legs. So get in, get out, get off your feet, do the race, and then worry about the fun swag later on. But a lot of people, I call it race size. I see it a little bit more in Ironman because it's just a 17-hour day, essentially.
Race eyes?
I call it race eyes. So the race morning, people are just so kind of in the zone, and they've got these big bulging eyes, and they may bump you, run into you, and it's all about them. Here now, get out of my way. It's me. My race is coming up. And they just have these kind of like frantic movements and stuff like that. And so what I would say is leading up to the race, whether it's race morning or the day before, don't be frantic. Try to enjoy what you're doing. Try to stay calm, cool, and collected. You burn a lot of nervous energy, especially if it's your first one.
Yeah.
So try to just, take your time. I'll also say that you're going to talk to a lot of people. In line the day before picking up your packet, the race morning.
I do that to try to keep my mind off the race.
That's a great thing to do, but at the same time, people want to tell you their life story. They want to tell you every little injury they had along the way, every dog that chased them, and all these things, and you could stand there for 2 hours the day before the race and all these things. So don't take anyone else's advice that you learned or heard of the day before. Oh man, you did this, or you use these types of socks. Oh man, I might need to do that. And you go buy something new and you get blisters by mile 8 and then you're in trouble. So don't take someone else's advice on those kind of pre-race environments and adopt that philosophy into your next day race. Stick to what you know and what you've prepared for. And one last thing is if you're getting out there early, you're walking through thousands of people essentially, and you're corralled in a certain corral, A, B, C, D. Some people start two or three streets a half mile away from other people, depending on how big the race is.
So you need to know in advance which corral you're a part of, where to show up, where to go to, and kind of know how to navigate, where to line up pre-race.
Yes, do all that research, get out there early, and then also know, because you can get stuck in crowds, not only before the race, but during the race even, and that 26.2-mile race may be 26.8 or 27-point-something miles because you're stuck in crowds, and if there's a left-hand turn coming up and you're stuck way on the right-hand side of the road, you've just added distance to your race. So we'll talk about tangents later, but position yourself in a smart, efficient way at the start line.
I mean, I'm so glad that we're talking about this question as pre-race is just crucial for having a great day. Jeff had already mentioned, so many great things about the days prior, packet pickup, kind of what to do there. Just a couple more things to touch on for the morning of the event. I've got kind of, a couple of recommendations there. We'll shorten it down to three. One, I'd say know your bathroom availability and plan accordingly. As part of your preparation and pre-race routine, know where the bathrooms are. Think about, kind of where you can go and what the lines might be like. You might also want to consider bringing your own toilet paper as well. That seems to be a good staple, and you will appreciate that, and I'm sure a couple other people around you that maybe didn't think of that would appreciate it too.
You can be the savior of their day.
Yes, yes, for sure. And then the importance of the corrals. Know when your corral opens and closes. I mean, I've seen it before where the race officials will close those corrals, and it doesn't matter that you were 30 seconds late.
Wow.
That you are no longer in that corral, and you have to go further back. And that could mess a little bit with your race plan as well. Knowing when your corral opens and closes is also going to play into kind of that bathroom availability and planning your morning timeline. And then within that timeline, I'd say the third thing to touch on for kind of some pre-race things to consider is make time and find an area to warm up. The corral area is usually very crowded, so you may need to find a side street and kind of plan for that. So, you know, I'll usually do that 10-minute jog and then find a side street to do some of those dynamic exercises and strides before getting to my corral with a little time to spare.
The longer the race, the more important pacing ourselves appropriately can become. How do we know what our race pace should be, and what are your top tips for staying on pace?
You know, I'll say this first of all, is that a lot of people want to bank time, especially...
Which banking time, if someone's unfamiliar with that, that is, okay, if you want to run an average 9-minute miles, you run faster than that early on so that when you start getting tired, you've banked that time.
I will say that is just the biggest mistake. You can make up, you know, a minute or two in the last couple miles of the race by going out conservative, feeling good, and finishing strong. But once you're hurting in a race, you're typically not going to get it back.
Yeah.
Right? And so especially going into that first one. So everyone kind of has an idea of what they're capable of. But, you know, I will add that be cognizant, you know, starting 2 weeks out of the race, you know, the weather's going to change 20 times between, you know, 15 days out and race day. But
absolutely.
But just watching the wind direction, is it going to change during the race? You know, is it going to be 20 miles per hour or 5? Is it going to be humid? You know, just knowing a little bit of those environmental conditions, but also kind of knowing, you know, where the hill's at, where they are at on the course. And I will say that 9 times out of 10 runners tend to run a little bit harder on an uphill than what they need to. And I will say that in my experience, marathoners, even if there's a hill or two inside of that 1 mile, they like to run even splits the entire race.
Yeah, so they're working too hard for that mile.
Yeah, so okay. That harder, kind of quote, harder mile with that hill in it, they might run effort-wise 45 seconds harder that mile just to run an even mile split, the same mile split as they did on the flat mile before that.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid on those hilly miles to let the overall average pace fall a little bit, because you'll make them up on those others. Have a strategy, know the course, get with your coach, and kind of understand how to adapt to those hills and those environmental conditions.
I would say the other thing that's just fantastic is RaceX. Because RaceX is going to outline your pace per mile for your best results. One thing that I would say as a tip for staying on pace and is just to take it 1 mile at a time. So, you know what the course is like. Know if, you know, there's going to be a hill here, if it's a downhill, kind of what the effort needs to be. And just focus on that current mile. And each mile that you can do, you know, staying within your race plan is a win. And so tips for staying on pace, like, don't get too far ahead of yourself. Just take it 1 mile at a time, one win at a time, and then conquer the next mile when you get there.
Yeah, I would just say be patient, right? If you're feeling good, just wait. Give yourself that mile mark. For me, it's mile 15. Okay, now I've been patient. I will reward myself by being able to maybe knock 5-10 seconds off that next mile.
So something that a lot of road races offer that triathlons just can't, you know, just by the nature of the sport, is you know, they'll have pace groups, or they'll have a pacer. You know, oftentimes it's guys working the race who you know, they'll have a sign, you know, 3:30, 3:40, 4 hours. 5 hours, and so if you're trying to hit a certain time, you can run with that guy the whole way, knowing that he's going to hold that pace for that pace group. Is this a good strategy if you're shooting for a good time, or is it better to just kind of ignore that and run how RaceX tells you to run.
You know, I'm going to go ahead and answer that. Pacers, pace groups can be good and bad. A lot of it depends on if that pacer of the pace group, you know, are they going to run in the center of this street the entire race, right? We alluded to tangents, right? If you run in the middle of the street, courses, you know, Boston qualifier courses or certified courses, I would even say, they don't have to be Boston only. They mark the distance based on perfect tangents. So if there's a turn a half mile down, they are going to take the tangent, the shortest distance between two points of that entire half mile stretch before the turn comes. And that's how they create 26.2 miles.
Wow.
And so if you run in the center of the street and there's a bunch of rights, a bunch of lefts inside of that race, you could add easily a whole entire mile to your race. You might see 27.2.
No thanks to that.
And there's hardly ever been a race where I've ever crossed the finish line in exactly 26.2. It might be 26.25, 26.3. And so if you're not taking perfect tangents, you will add a lot of time or a lot of distance to your race, which will knock down your average pace. Kind of know is that you can even ask that pace leader, you know, are you going to run in the center of the street? Are you good at taking tangents? Are you cognizant of that? So you could keep them in view, but yeah, you may want to leave the group to take a tangent or something like that. But anyways, bigger races will have these pace groups. And the bigger races also kind of announce on their website, okay, the 3 to 310 group will have this person. They've done this 10 times before. Here's their credentials. And a lot of times their contact info will be on there. So a month, 2, 3 months before the race, maybe you shoot them an email. Hey, what's your strategy? Are you going to run perfectly even splits throughout?
Are you going to negative split?
Are you going to negative split? Are you going to bank time? Because I, you know, may or may not want to do that. My coach has me doing this. So reach out to them if you can. But I would say, you know the strategy that you're going to do beforehand. You know, has that person done one of these pace things before, you know, and stuff like that. There's just a number of reasons and how they can help you or how they can hurt you. It depends on how serious your goals are. If it's just your first one and you would just love to break 4 hours, then run with that individual. But I mean, by all means.
Yeah, I won't repeat everything that Rain said there, but I would 100% agree that, you know, running with a pace group and knowing what their strategy is will help you decide if that's going to be an appropriate thing for you. And then just to add to that, you know, don't be afraid to break away from that group when it doesn't serve your own race strategy. I mean, it happens that pacers have bad days too. So you also don't want to be fully reliant on them. They can get off pace. They can have, you know, GPS issues with their watch.
Have feelings too.
Yes. Yeah. And so whether that's, you know, needing to back off and not necessarily stick with the group for a portion of that where they would be pushing harder than what's serving your race plan, or, you know, going ahead of the group when your race is going well, you know, be prepared to follow your own race plan. And if it just happens to meet your plan and you have some company along the way, then, I mean, that's a bonus.
A dreaded thing in the long distance road racing world is hitting the wall and or bonking. And I've heard some people say the wall at a marathon is at mile 23. Some people will tell you it's at mile 19. Some people will tell you it's at mile 21. But everybody dreads the idea of getting deep into that race that you've trained so hard for and just hitting the wall, bonking, running out of energy. What does this look like and how can you avoid it happening to you?
Well, Andrew, even the best fall down sometimes. literally,
there's a song
and
for that.
Literally, fall down in marathons and running, and sometimes it's the hitting the wall or bonking. And so, the human body isn't designed to run all out, you know, for that distance. It's tough. It's such a unique distance, and hitting the wall, bonking, is typically, it's a nutrition aspect, right? You run out of energy stores to hold that aggressive of a pace for that long. But typically, I see it in that it's when people race a little bit harder than they train, or maybe they didn't hit or follow their training plan perfectly, and then they go out Or maybe it's what we alluded to earlier. Maybe you did some sort of test or assessment, 5K, 10K, or a half marathon, and you used a simple online converter. Okay, I ran this for a shorter distance, so I should be able to hit this for a long.
And it might be too aggressive or incorrect for your ability. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe you didn't take into account hills and environmental conditions and stuff like that. Or what I also see a lot is that, you know, people train in a certain location, then they travel a couple hundred miles away, a couple states away even, to go do that big fun A race. And the altitude differential is different. The temperature, humidity is all different than the conditions at which they trained in. And so there's just a lot of things that can happen on race day. Maybe, you know, the food that was available for you traveling, you know, is a different pre-race meal than what you had. So just there's so much that go into race day and so many things that can hinder you. But all those things together, one of all those things, you know, all of that can factor into bonking or hitting the wall. But typically it's not having that nutrition strategy. The human body can only store up and have enough energy in stores to last about, you know, 60 to 90 minutes at hard intensity.
Mid-race.
So yeah, you have to refuel inside of a marathon. You have to eat and you have to drink. And if you don't do that correctly, then those energy stores run out.
So just like we kind of preach with triathlon, it's practicing that in your long sessions and training and knowing, you know, what your body needs calorie wise to get you through a race of that duration, and then keeping yourself, you know, topped off on the energy stores on race day, right?
Yeah, I think hitting the wall and bonking is a whole podcast in itself, but essentially what it is it's a defense mechanism. You're late into the race, your energy stores are low, and your body is in an alert, alarming state, and it's trying to let you know, hey, I'm running out of my energy stores here, the gas light is on, and so your body is literally trying to slow you down, cramp, stop your muscles, stop your body, so you can recover.
We need a podcast episode called Debunking the Bonk. and talk all about that. When you spectate at a marathon, not unlike a triathlon, actually, there's just this pageantry of colors between the run shoes and the singlets and arm sleeves and compression socks. And every runner, of course, is geared up a little bit differently. Is there like an optimal attire that we should wear for optimum performance? Or is marathon culture just wear what you like to wear and there isn't any pros and cons?
I would say that optimal attire is light, comfortable, and weather appropriate.
That's a good way to summarize that.
Yeah. I'm going to emphasize the weather appropriate there because my best running performances have been in very different attire, from shorts and a singlet in a marathon I ran last fall to, I mean, rain jacket, hat, and gloves during Boston 2018. I've had very different, albeit very appropriate attire for, you know, those races over the last couple of years. So you're going to want to wear something that gives you kind of an optimal body temperature, whether that's, you know, a couple layers or a rain jacket to stay warm, or, you know, light clothing with shorts and a singlet to stay cool. And then something that doesn't create a lot of additional drag. So you want it to fit well, and you don't want, you know, more drag than would be necessary to kind of keep your temperature at that optimal place.
So a 26.2 mile long course does not always end up being 26.2 miles on our watch by the time we're done. And Jeff, you've already mentioned this and talked about the tangents and running them. Because if we aren't smart out there, you know, we can find ourselves easily running way further than intended. So Jeff, you've mentioned running tangents, but maybe what are all the strategies that you have for running the course as efficiently as possible?
Yeah, good point. So you know, a tangent is defined as the shortest distance between two points, and so we want to take the tangents to get as close to 26.2 miles as we can. Hence, that yields you know, a faster finish time and all that stuff. Some things that I will do if my nutrition is not at jeopardy, I will even skip aid stations. I don't drink at every single aid station that is available for me in a standalone half or full marathon. And if there's a left-hand turn coming up and the aid station is on the right-hand side of the street, I'm not going to run all the way across the street and add 10, 20, 30 feet to my
You're
race
just gonna skip it.
To grab an ounce of water to then turn around and get back to that spot before that turn. And so that just, you know, that 1 or 2 ounces of water isn't going to speed me up enough to negate that 5 or 8, whatever seconds I just added by going to grab that cup of water. So I would kind of know on the map, where are the aid stations on the course? Where do they coincide with the tangents and the turns? And just kind of know, okay, I'm going to skip the mile 3 one because at mile 4, 4.5, the aid station is placed for me in a better spot. Stuff like that. So knowing the course, knowing where the aid station are. Also know kind of the slopes of the road, right? When if there's just a bunch of left-hand turns, or you want to take a perfect tangent, but that means the entire race, you know, your left leg may be longer than your right leg, right? Because the slope, and so one of your legs takes kind of more torque, let's say, or more ground contact time than the other leg. Well, that's probably the leg that's going to start cramping first. So kind of just know, you know, okay, I have a 3 mile straight section before a right-hand turn. So maybe I want to run perfectly in the middle of the road, you know, take a longer tangent to get to the middle of the road. You know, don't just run straight to the middle of the road, but take some time to gradually work your way into the middle of the road so you're spreading out that slope evenly, because on, you know, the left-hand side of the road, it may slope up towards the middle of the road, and then it's going to slope back down the other direction as you approach the right-hand side of the road, right? Because that's water runoff. You know, my wife is an engineer for the state, TxDOT.
Oh, cool.
Texas Department of Transportation. And so just those little things like that, just kind of knowing, you know, the sloping of the roads, and as you run across it. So you may say, hey, this 5 mile stretch, you're allowed to run on that middle stripe. Oh, you know what? These turns are so short. They're only a quarter mile. It's okay to run on the slope because it's only a quarter mile, because it's going to make your tangent much shorter. So little things like that can literally take minutes off of your finish time. If you're going to run in the middle of the road, a lot of times there are reflectors or sewer lids, you know, maybe drain grates that you're going to run over. And so if you're in a pack of 10, 20, 30 people, sometimes you don't see those reflectors. So I see people all the time rolling ankles.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
Falling.
It's not like riding, cycling in a pack where people call out obstructions coming up.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And actually,
or even like the big posts on bicycle paths or cones. I mean, there's some dangerous things you've got to be aware of.
Wow.
Yeah. And then kind of lastly, you know, in headwinds, make a smart decision. It may be worth it for you to tuck behind someone and draft. It's perfectly legal to draft in running. And so even in triathlon on the run, you can draft, you can't on the bike. But, you know, you may say, oh my gosh, you know, this unexpected headwind just hit me in the face. This is crazy. I don't want to fight this for the next X number of miles. So it may even be worth it to you to tuck behind someone, even if, you know, it hurts your pace a little bit, to save that energy rather than fight it the whole time. So wind direction is another one you may
want to
look
particularly
at
on these longer races where, you know, you do have a longer duration that you're out there running for, you know, to save a little time, you know, slow down a little bit, tuck in behind somebody to save the energy for later. It's a good point.
Yeah. And even if you know that person you're drafting off of isn't taking perfect tangents, it might still be worth it to you, you know, to add a slight bit of distance to your race, knowing that you're negating that by conserving energy on the headwind.
And that's where, I mean, going back to the pace groups, they can be beneficial too. I mean, you've got built-in wind blocks there if, you know, it's following your race strategy.
Very true. So as a coach, let's kind of wrap up today with this one. There's just been so much marathon wisdom in this episode. And but just as coaches, you know, what would you guys consider to be kind of that top piece of marathon wisdom, that tip or that piece of advice you want to be at the forefront of your athletes' minds as they line up to start their kind of longer distance road races? What would you say that tip is for you?
You know, kind of the almost the whole podcast here in one sentence would be this. I'd say be patient. Again, don't bank time early. Take the tangents. Run with joy. Enjoy what you're doing. Don't get too caught up in everything. Oh my gosh, I'm 3 seconds off that mile and let it ruin your entire race, right? You'll hear this a lot. Don't trust a fart. Had to say it. Had to throw it in there.
Got to be said on a marathon episode. And had to be said.
We couldn't do the podcast without that, right?
Sorry, guys. And then lastly, you know, don't do anything new on race day that you haven't done in your training.
Mine's a little shorter, but I would just say 1 mile at a time. that, you know, if you go in thinking, oh my gosh, like I got to run 26 miles or I got to hold this pace for, you know, hours upon hours, it can feel daunting. So, you know, just take it 1 mile at a time, 1 win at a time, 1 foot in front of the other. It's going to be a good day.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Completing a marathon is a grand achievement for sure. And for every marathon run, there is a corresponding story with what happened out there on course during those 26.2 miles. I threw out a post on the I Am Tridot Facebook group inviting athletes to share their favorite marathon race day stories, and we had just some fantastic submissions. A big thanks to all the athletes that took a moment to send me a story. There were stories of fighting through an injury, stories ending in marriage proposals, stories of knocking down PRs and qualifying for Boston. Just truly some great stuff out there from you all. I'm going to share one today, and we'll definitely share some more of your marathon stories on upcoming episodes of the podcast. Today's story comes from Heather from Pennsylvania. This is her account of completing the Marine Corps Marathon on a rainy day that also just so happened to be her birthday.
Hello, Tridot Ambassador Heather Macklin here. One of my most memorable marathon race day stories has to be the Marine Corps Marathon from last October, 2019. There was very, very heavy rain in Quantico. I remember hopping on the train, going from the hotel to the starting line. A couple of my friends joined me and they were doing the 10K. So they had different starting point than I did for the marathon. So we kind of parted ways and I was in the opposite direction. So there I was getting off the train in my poncho. And I had dry shoes in a bag so I could just swap them out and at least start the race with a dry set of sneakers on. Interesting story. I was in line, the porta potty line. So many of us in races have been in that porta potty line pre-race and you never know who you're going to meet. I met a woman named Molly. Small world. My daughter's name is Molly. We immediately had a connection. Her dad was a Marine and he happened to pass away 4 months before the race due to illness. And we shared a special moment together. She actually won the lottery that year to race in that, and she felt like it was kind of meant to be. So we really connected, and I only spoke with her for about 15 minutes, but I will never forget that conversation. And she totally gave me the motivation to suck it up that day and to power through all that insane weather. So we had a rolling start. Right at the beginning, I had my dry Hokas. So I threw them on, started running, and slowly ripped the poncho off and took it to a trash can. This race was, interestingly enough, on my birthday. Why not run a marathon on your birthday? I had all the right intentions. I was all hyped up. They announced my name with about 30 others at the start and wished us a happy birthday. Thank goodness I was not the only one crazy enough to run in this horrible rain on my birthday. Mile 5, I saw a guy with a "It's my birthday" written on the back of his shirt. I slapped him on the back, said, "Happy birthday, mine too." And at the same time, we both looked at each other and said, what were we thinking? So I kept running, told him to have a great race. About midway through the race, there was the Blue Mile, and it's a silent mile honoring all of the fallen heroes. Very, very emotional experience to go through, I'm sure dry, as well as wet. So they had pics of those who lost their lives fighting for our country. And several Marines were lined up holding flags as we ran through this area, and ponding water at this point was filling the roads and the running trails. And I kept telling myself to keep going no matter what. Every step is one step closer to the finish line. And it was very emotional to see all of the Marines holding up those flags in this terrible weather. And it just gave me so much more motivation to continue. So during mile 23, the sun finally came out. It was like a 5K left until I was gonna cross that finish line. The rain did not cool things off. The sun was very bright and the temperature rose quickly along with loads of humidity. It was a beautiful finish. It actually brought tears to my eyes at the finish line. I high-fived quite a few Marines as I crossed. They placed the finisher medal around my neck and I felt like it was an invaluable experience. The soggiest race I ever ran. Flights in DC were grounded for 45 minutes during that race, I found out post-race. But what was awesome is there was still people cheering all along the race course. The rain didn't hold them back from showing amazing support. I will never forget that experience. That was the last race that I participated in before COVID-19 interfered with our race schedules and our lives. It makes me appreciate what I was able to experience even more.
Well, that's it for today, folks. Thanks so much to Heather for sharing the story of racing in the rain at the Marine Corps Marathon. Listen, we do a lot of random things on the cooldowns of these podcast episodes, and I want you all to realize that putting your stories on our podcast is my absolute favorite way to cool down our shows. Everyday athletes like you and me are just the heartbeat of endurance sports, and I never get tired of hearing different folks' stories. So if you, like Heather, have had a memorable day racing a marathon or an Ironman or any other endurance event, please let me know. I want to put your story on the show. Head to tryout.com/podcast and click on Leave Us a Voicemail. And right there on the website, you can record your story into your phone or computer, and they go straight from our website to my email inbox. A big thanks to coaches Jeff Raines and Elizabeth James for talking marathon and half marathon training with us today. And a shout out to TriTats for partnering with us on today's episode. We'll do it all again soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.